Up. Come on, Bobby, let's go potting. All right, everybody, welcome into the analysis. We got a big one for you here. This is, of course, the Barbenheimer pod. The biggest pod of our careers, perhaps. We've been talking about Barbie and Oppenheimer and all the thrills of a big movie box office weekend. You're listening to the analysis. All right. How do you like that Aqua reference in there?
I did. Yeah. We're going to have to do a little outro with Aqua today.
Yeah, big time.
I was a big fan of that song.
Yeah, it was a huge hit.
I remember as a kid being in some sort of, I can't even remember the name of CD stores anymore because we haven't used them in the last like 20 years. But I remember being torn between buying the new Weird Al CD or the Aqua CD, and I only had $20. And I was like, left hand, right hand. It was almost like the Birkenstock versus the high-heeled shoe. I was like, what do I choose?
You got to go Weird Al on that one. Like, are you talking about like Bad Hair Day or the Jurassic Park
Running one? With Scissors.
Oh. Dude, Alapalooza. Bad Hair Day was my first CD I ever bought. How about that?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's dive in.
Yeah, ADD has already taken its course.
Barbenheimer is upon us. People are excited to be back to the movies. This is what Christopher Nolan wanted with Tenet, and it did not happen. Mm-hmm. We tried with No Time to Die, got it a little bit going. People came out for Spider-Man 3. Maverick, you know, first movie to hit a billion. Sound the sirens.
Of course, I knew that was coming.
But this is... so much bigger. The movies have vastly outperformed even the wildest projections. Talk me before we get into numbers here. I want how did you consume? Did you do the doubleheader? Which did you see first? What was your viewing experience?
So I did see both in the opening weekend. I did not see them on the same day, if that's what you mean by doubleheader. Yeah. I did Barbie first on a Saturday 2 o'clock show in the Regal that's close to me in South Florida here, which I love, and you know, I'm now a big Regal stan. The theaters are very nice. It's very modern. They've been doing a nice job. So I saw it by myself. What I would say, I hadn't seen a movie theater with that much buzz and people inside of it. Even like back in the 2007, 2008 days, it like really reminded me of kind of the experience, a different Chris Nolan film, but Dark Knight, like that kind of like everybody, that's the thing that the whole
me and you
collective.
Saw Dark Knight on a Navy Pier, did we not?
No, we
or I saw I, it there.
Me and you, that was yeah, I can't remember where me and you had seen it later, but yeah, you'd probably seen it at Navy Pier. I think I was still in finishing up college.
Navy Pier and IMAX.
But yeah, it's just like kind of like that, like this is the event that we are collectively doing, and I think it was great. There was so much pink. Dudes were wearing pink. Like there was a lot of people dressed up. The theater I was at had a full row of kind of like women in their probably like late 20s, early 30s. All of them. When you get the 2001 Space Odyssey doll that comes out, there was like cheering. It was so fucking hype. Yeah. And so it was just cool because like Hollywood needed a win, but like movie theaters even more so needed a win. So I think just that the poor Regal staff, I'm sure they had all hands on deck then some, but you can't just go and like triple your staff for one weekend that's going to explode. And so they were just like, just trying their best to keep it above water.
How do I heat up these White Castle sliders? I just got here.
I don't know. We're out of butter.
What's a junior mint? I'm 12 years old.
We're out of Sierra Miss syrup. Where's the syrup?
Pops flying everywhere.
Yeah, honestly, but it was really freaking cool. And then Brecken got in from seeing Beyonce on Sunday. She saw Beyonce on Saturday, so she wasn't at Barbie with me. But then she actually wanted to go see Oppenheimer with me because she was like, if I don't see Oppenheimer with you, I probably won't see it. So I can see Barbie whenever, but like, let's do Oppenheimer. So I got kind of RPX, which is Regal's version of IMAX. I got us tickets for that on Sunday night. So then I got I landed the plane with Oppenheimer on Sunday. How about you?
Reckon pulling in with a face full of stoked off of Beyonce right into Oppenheimer. Well, was that a come down? Did you guys enjoy it?
She loved it.
Yeah.
She said that's one of her favorite movies she's seen in years. I don't want to spoil all my Oppenheimer takes, but obviously it's a masterclass in a lot of different ways. It's like incredible filmmaking, and that was a different type of a hype. I enjoyed that experience.
Two completely hyped experiences for almost the exact opposite reasons. Having said that, a lot of people were doing the doubleheader, and you could see some teenagers in pink being like, what the hell am I watching?
Because they had just gotten done with Barbie.
Yeah, just got done with Barbie, and they're like, this movie fucking sucks.
Yeah, you have to go Oppenheimer first, Barbie second.
I disagree.
Really?
After watching Oppenheimer, I was just kind of like almost shell-shocked and being like, because it's 3 hours of like pretty intense cutting and really fast moving, and then it's like this visceral experience with the bomb, and you're just like kind of shell-shocked literally. And I couldn't imagine then going into another movie. Whereas, so I saw Barbie opening.
Barbie kind of energizes you, and you're like,
yeah,
let's
you're like,
keep
damn,
going.
Yeah, the fucking movies are back.
All right,
let's go
I'm
see
with
Oppenheimer.
You.
Let's go.
You know what? I'm flip-flopping here. I'm going full John Kerry. Bring me the Hayes aside. Oppenheimer second.
Yeah. There we go. Say I think the best way to do it is to split it up, like do one, like at least give it a day. Like
okay, so then I won. Then
so
my move in.
Here's what I did. So I started with Barbie like you did. I saw it opening day Thursday. I drove down to LA. A friend of mine. We had dinner. Went to a 7:30 screening. Madhouse, Sherman Oaks Galleria. I mean, every theater in LA was packed. The AMC, the Regals, I think they had like the Barbie box, like a Instagram wall sort of thing.
We had one of those too at the Regal.
So
sound the siren every time I say Regal.
Yeah. No free advertising on the pod.
But anyway, they had the box. People were getting in. There was a line for the fucking box. The line for the box was almost as long as the line for the butterless popcorn.
Butterless? Man, I'd be in the line for the butter pop. So Thursday night, opening weekend, packed, huge. Usually I'm seeing these movies by myself.
Yeah, theater alone.
Yeah, just, hey, I can't
lights are left
Keanu
on
because
it's not even worth turning the lights off.
Yeah, right. Well, past lives, indie darlings. This was like jamming. Everyone wearing pink, everyone dressed up. I was like, hell yeah, this is fucking exciting. And then I didn't know much about Barbie going in, so I was just I hadn't really taken in the marketing juggernaut so much. I hadn't seen a bunch of trailers. I was like, how are they going to frame this? What is even the story to tell? Is this just going to be a long commercial? Like, you know, kind of like Air, but even more so Mattel and just like a bunch of pink. But we'll get into the takes later. So super hyped for that. And then got a chance to kind of absorb it. Have a cocktail, you know, kind of just because I was buzzing, you know what I mean? And I would have been cool to go into an Oppenheimer had, you know, made a late screening. But so I do that. I do an Oppenheimer matinee the next day at the home of theater, basically TCL, Chinese Grauman's Theater, heart of Hollywood, true 70mm full IMAX. There's
there
only two in California. I think there's only 30 screens in the country. And it's how Nolan wants you to see it. It's 11 miles of film. You know, we've heard all that crap. So during, you know, because 70 millimeters, large format, it goes wide. IMAX is digital, but digital 70 millimeters, the full, tall, three-story experience. You know, like in Dark Knight, that opening scene with the vista over Chicago. It's just like when it fills up that full screen, there's nothing like it. And to see Cillian Murphy, you know, black and white, just and the explosion and all those beautiful moments. It was truly incredible. So I was excited to have a moment to kind of take in both. I don't think the doubleheader is, despite the internet craze.
Trying to make it a thing,
Yeah, and I think just seeing it in a weekend was an awesome event. And if you're going to do the doubleheader, I kind of like Barbie, get dinner, see Oppenheimer. I think that's the way to go. But either way, splitting up with a meal or you know, a night to compress is the way to go. I just want to get to the numbers a little bit here. So Barbie opened with 160 million domestic, Oppenheimer 88 million, almost doubling production projections. This was the fourth highest earning weekend in history.
Yeah.
And the only other ones above 300 million. So number one is the weekend that Endgame came out.
Of course.
That was 90% of the haul.
Okay, that's another weekend that was huge buzzing. Like, you go to the theater, and like that was kind of the event everyone was doing. So,
well, yeah. It was also the Game of Thrones finale. So, like, okay. A lot of buzz weekend for that, right? So 2019, before the pandemic, the last time people went to the movies. Endgame, 90% of the haul, 400 million total. Number two, Avengers Infinity War, you know, the mm-hmm. year before. That was 82% of the haul for 314. And then Star Wars The Force Awakens, that was like a big event, right? That was like, oh my God, everyone's back. Movie mm-hmm. theaters are full. That was 80% of the haul for 313. Barbenheimer, 311 million, just under The Force Awakens. Barbie was 52%. Oppenheimer was 26%. Like, we haven't seen like a double bill crushing in forever.
Because normally they avoid each other.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
a lot exactly. of times they don't want to go up against each other. They, you know, they kind of figure it out, and it's like, let this movie have the spotlight for a couple weeks, and then when the mm-hmm. energy kind of is starting to taper off, then we'll come in, and you know, we'll get some of the additional lift of people looking for a new blockbuster to take on.
Right.
So, yeah.
I mean,
a lot of times they don't
the
go
whole
at
blockbuster summer, right? And people clear out, especially for these Marvel tent poles. Like nowadays, it's like, oh my God. Let's like let's back off and you know, give them some runway, and then maybe we'll sneak in an A24 to kind of grab the people that don't give a shit about Marvel. And so, what I love about it's just that like people were seeing both. There was like hype for both, but like the Oppenheimer fans are not necessarily going to be Barbie fans. It's just it kind of was the perfect two films to go up against each other.
I was asked a really good question by somebody at work, and they said, do you think, given the themes of the two movies, that the releases were meant to complement each other, whether that was intentional or not?
I don't think so, because of the fact that Nolan left Warner Brothers, you know what I mean, like acrimoniously or mm-hmm. non. And so they were in direct competition in a way. And I think they both helped each other out and springboarded yeah. the other. And so maybe the execs were like, fuck it, this internet thing has taken off. But I think initially, like, is it Paramount now? So Nolan's at Paramount, but like all of his movies before had been Warner Brothers. So then it was kind of like, well, fuck it, we're going to put up our big tentpole against your 3-hour historical biopic. I think it worked out for everybody, but initially I don't think that they were in cahoots or
yeah.
trying to help each other out at all.
One of my favorite parts about it, though, was and we had kind of mentioned it on the end of our Mission Impossible podcast, but the, you know, one ticket for Oppenheimer, one ticket for Barbie, like the two different types of people that would order, you know, whether it was like office characters or whether it was, you know whatever, just the memes of what type of person is going to Oppenheimer versus Barbie. And that's probably honestly what they were thinking about from a marketing standpoint, is there's not going to be a lot of overlap in terms of the fan bases that are going to like the historical character drama buff is probably also not going to have similar interest in Barbie. So let's just it might not matter if we release them at the same time, but then they ended up getting swept up in each other, and it became yeah. that helped. You're right.
Totally. I mean, I just love all like the fan art, like the joint posters, the merch.
Barbie like within the A-bomb, but then yeah. Oppenheimer with like a pink hat and a pink tie. Yeah.
So, all of it. There's like so much. It's awesome. It's like this viral internet sensation. I mean, just free marketing. It's amazing. I've never seen it. I do love. I mean, you brought up Dark Knight. I love the fact that people have mentioned, you know, Dark Knight and Mamma Mia walked so Barbenheimer could run. You know, I mean, the last time these diametrically yeah. opposed movies came out on the same day, and people were, you know, jazzed for both of them. And I don't know the numbers of that opening. I mean, I'm sure it did really well because Dark Knight was just the repeat business of Dark Knight was.
There was no one dressed up to go see Mamma Mia though. There was no the energy around Mamma Mia definitely not the same. But plus, I see what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a fun little, yeah, okay, we get it. But, like, who directed Mamma Mia, right? I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, this is a Greta Gerwig. You know, she's got a lot of momentum. You know, Noah Baumbach co-wrote it with her and all this. Yeah. You know, you do, was it Frances Ha? And then, you know, Little Bird.
Green Bird.
Sorry.
Lady Bird.
Lady Bird into mm-hmm. Little Women. And, you know, she's kind of building up into the... And then a lot of people have used the comparison where... You know, you think about Christopher Nolan doing what Insomnia Memento, and then he grabs Batman Begins to try, and he does, you know, the trilogy to springboard him into this incredible blockbuster genius. Yeah. And where people are saying like maybe Greta is doing the same thing. You know, she's this indie darling, great films, Little Women probably had a decent budget, got some Oscar buzz, but now doing a big IP property like this to springboard her into maybe a dynamic, you know, blockbuster, top grossing female director of all time now.
That's amazing. Yeah, that was one part of the stats that we haven't hit yet is that it's the largest opening for a female director. It's
solo or otherwise, because I guess...
And also the largest opening of a non-sequel, non-superhero driven story.
Yeah, so. That's my favorite thing. So like what Barbie did its opening weekend, The Flash has yet to accomplish in like 2 months. It's amazing. Like 268 million worldwide in one weekend. The Flash fucking... bullshit piece that still has yet to do it. I just love people are sick of that stuff finally, so it's like, you know, you do something, you market something well, you give people exciting new
perspective
movies,
something
exciting, and they'll come out for it. I think I just love that still exists. It's, you know, like the enthusiasm, it felt like when we and you were seeing like Independence Day or Men in Black or Liar Liar, just like so hyped to go to the, it was always packed.
Yeah.
You had to get there early because there was no assigned seating. You know, you might end up in the front row if you got there when the movie started. I can't remember. I think maybe Dark Knight is the last time where, I mean, for me, it was No Time to Die, because like when I went down to LA, like the movie theaters were packed and, you know, people were hype and dressed up for that. And, but that was maybe a microcosm of the LA experience. But man, just an awesome time to be a movie fan. And
We're obviously huge fans of the industry. So it was, I don't know, and I don't know if you had this experience, but I really wanted to take a moment and enjoy the experience of the collective. And that might sound a little preachy and douchey, but you know, we love the industry. We do see value in going to the theater and the theater experience and a collective group of people like laughing together, crying together. There's a lot of tears during Barbie in the theater I was at. And it's like that, like that's why we're here. And that's kind of the magic of it all. And so it wasn't lost on me that I might not, I can't take that for granted that it's just going to happen again. So I was like, let me just take the moment. Let me enjoy this here. Let me just celebrate the industry because I might not have a lot of opportunities to do this. I think theaters will continuously kind of the business model and the framework of it. I think it's going to continue to struggle. And so you just never know. And I just was like, I'm going to enjoy this here.
No, definitely. I mean, that's why I kind of want to go do it again this weekend as we approach the second weekend. You know, I mean, already projections are like another 85 for Barbie, another 45 for Oppenheimer. Just like they're adding more and more screens. I think this is going to steamroll into like people have missed out on something, a big event now. And like even
people underestimate the power of FOMO.
Exactly. 100%. Like people that are like, I don't go to the theater anymore. It's I'll just wait for it to come out. Like you've missed out now. And so
Uncle Terry went to see Barbie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Uncle Terry.
Gay.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
Figured he'd be there opening weekend.
Yeah, he was probably dressed as one earring Ken, but I disagree. Sugar Daddy.
Or Alan. He's more of an Alan. I mean, Uncle Terry's an Alan for sure.
Yeah, Terry, you Alan. All right. Let's get some takes, baby. Let's lead off with Barbie, because that's how you suggested it, right? You
had an absolute blast with this. I was so blown away at how it was. I found it hilarious, genuinely moving, just gorgeous to look at, and had something to say. Obviously, there's a lot of kind of right wing bullshit about like, oh, they won't be happy until we're all gay. Like, it's just anti men.
I don't even want to give it a time of day.
Exactly.
Those points of view. Yeah.
Just
I'd
ridiculous.
Keep marching past that.
Just what a fun ride, man. I mean, I had heard rumblings that like, how are they going to frame this? How, what are they going to do with it? When I saw the photos of Margot and Ryan Gosling in Venice Beach and like the bright outfits, I was like, a live action Barbie, do we even need this? But then once we get on set and like the gorgeous production design, the jokes, just like how smart it was written, I was like, holy shit, this is blowing me away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hilarious. Like, everything was landing very close to home. I think, women and men were both catching strays left and right. You know what I mean? I think they hit both of them equally. Like, a lot of relatable stuff. Like, oh my God, how many times have we, oh my God, you've never seen Godfather?
Oh, the Godfather bit, I almost hit in my hands. I was like, it, me, oh, I'm such a piece of shit. And if I knew a guitar, I'd be singing Matchbox 20.
Yeah, right.
Let me play the guitar at you. What a great line. Just let me, I'm going to go get my guitar.
Amazing
and I'll play it at
song
you.
Choice, too. Because, you know, the cheap thing is just be like, oh, and anyway, here's Oasis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, here's Wonderwall. But then, like, the teaching women how to.
Oh, the mansplaining. Yeah.
I mean, I've never done that, but, like, with darts, I have. I was like, ah, shit.
Yeah, just ask them how to do something, and we'll show you.
Yeah.
Oh, God, so good. She really nails it, the Zack Snyder cut line.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting the Kens to mansplain, and, that's going to distract them enough for us to grab the Barbies and give them this really epic. It reminded me a lot, America Ferrera's speech on the how we're always failing.
Yeah.
Right, and we're supposed to be this, but we're also supposed to be this, and you know, I don't want to do a disservice by paraphrasing it, but that reminded me a lot of I'm so sick of a woman's place, Saoirse Ronan monologue in Little Women. Like, mm-hmm. Greta's so good at these moments in the movie where she just kind of, like, let somebody take the stage and just straight up preach, and I just like that was a really powerful scene. But and then that's how they get all the Barbies to take down their brainwashes.
Do that, yeah.
Just do that over and over and over again because that's what we need, you know. And so, but I really loved it. I was honestly, Barbie made me want to be a better dude to my fiance. Like the next morning, I woke up and like. Participated a lot more in like cleaning and grocery shopping. It was like it really did have just a little bit of an impact on me in terms of like what are some of the ways that I'm kind of kenning around my house and my life and my relationship and how can I be better. So anyway, just I thought it impacted me.
Made you a better partner. I think that's like, and that's what's so great about what Greta has done. You know, like Joker's a perfect example of a movie that they were trying to talk about mental illness, but they couldn't get that movie made. So they had to like shoehorn it into a fucking Batman vehicle. This is a way more successful and fun version of that, where it's like we have a lot to say about, you know, the patriarchy and society and how it's hard to be a woman. And it's not just like about commercialization of a doll. This movie has a lot to say that, they've used a Mattel, and Mattel's going to make a shitload of money in merchandising.
Yeah, they've reinvented Barbie in a better way. Like, they have rebranded it, I believe.
Yeah. But no, I think it was a great vehicle to get these messages out there. And some people may be exhausted by the message or.
Movies needing a message.
Yeah, right. And I think this was like a perfect example of having your cake and eating it too, where you can say something profound when also entertaining people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just totally nailed it, right? Just like,
yeah. And I love a good metaphor hunt. you know me, and I right. love to go, and I love to listen to directors and writers, and kind of basically they don't need to tell me explicitly. I think the film does a lot of it, and you know she says it through her characters. But kind of what's the you know what's the director trying to get me to take away with this? And for guys like me and you, and I'm sure a lot of people, like sometimes we go to the theater or go see a movie to learn a little something. And mm-hmm. I think not everything needs to be a lecture. But I do think this movie is accomplishing a lot in I think it's like South Park level satire, and oh, me yeah. and you love South Park, but yes. it really reminded me of some kind of like South Park points of view. And it was like, you know, you're looking at the kind of the when you see like Barbie leaving the Barbie world and going to the real world, a lot of times satirically what they're saying is that's kind of the commercialized almost like childhood idealism. And then when she goes to the real world, it's kind of that like real world truth that you kind of get smacked in the face with. And,
right.
you know, a lot of times and what Greta's trying to say with, you know, Ken and like Ken's impact on the Kendom and, you know, the
discovering the patriarchy and horses. And
yeah. everything. But like a lot of times misogyny is what gets you out of your kind of childhood idealism and fantasies is yeah. like kind of like your interaction with misogyny as a woman is going to kind of end your childhood experience. And so I just think that that's like was so well done. And honestly, like Barbie's transition at the end and like going to the gynecologist, like that's very deliberate. Like that's womanhood, right?
Big and so laugh it's like, line in my theater. I'm sure yours as well. Like because it's a setup where like, oh, we're going to get like working girl here. Like, oh, okay, she's joining yeah. the workforce. No, she's getting her genitalia.
She has
at.
Genitals now, yeah. which is a callback to an early bit, which was fucking hilarious. But when Ken and Barbie meet the two are the construction workers, and she's like, "We don't have genitals, either of us." And then Ken hangs back for a second. He's like, "I have genitals." So yeah, but like you know, that's there's like themes about like Barbie's place in childhood. There's like. Body image issues with you know with that plays out a lot. They like kind of like address a lot of kind of the problematic idealism behind Barbie, but also evolve it. They reframe it. I think it has you know it really has a lot to do with you know obviously like there's feminist themes that are I think are really well done. But I just like that type of storytelling. I'm very engaged with, and I honestly thought that the characters, all of the characters, were really endearing and relatable. I just like yeah. like I found myself getting very emotional about like a lot of not just the speech from the mother to the Barbies, but like a lot of Margot Robbie's moments as well were really good. And you know me, I'm like Margot Robbie, I'm a champion for, and I
what
will
a
ride.
Star.
I just think she's so great,
having such a great year as well. I mean, we already talked about Asteroid City, just pulls up and just drains the three in that movie. She was a co-producer on this. She handpicked Ryan Gosling and just, I mean, incredible chemistry, the two of them. She's totally crushing it. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you think about going back to Wolf of Wall Street, you're like, who is this total bombshell?
Yeah.
You're like, okay, maybe we'll never see her again. Holy crap. But then, like, what a career. Like, a totally legit badass. And then, you know, Babylon Hive, me and you may be the only people I know that like fucking love that movie.
Yeah.
Well, with it. But yeah, her,
we understand. But yeah, and I loved her. She's what made me love it. And yeah. there's a lot of things to like about this movie, but she's so perfectly cast. They even mm-hmm. reference how great of a casting they have in the dialogue of the movies. Mm-hmm. And I just, that was another great line, which was like,
it was a Helen Mirren as the narrator, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically like a note to the filmmakers trying to make this point while also casting Margot Robbie is
right.
was not a great take or whatever,
yeah.
but like
stunningly gorgeous woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Even without makeup and crying, like still yeah. just super hot. Yeah. yeah. Still amazing. So
I'm not enough. No, it just speaks to the fact that like even, perfect, was it like stereotypical Barbie, this gorgeous Hollywood movie star, Margot Robbie, you know, she struggles with identity and feeling like it's enough, right? And
yeah,
I mean, who do you think won the movie here? I mean, a lot of people are coming out here saying like Ryan Gosling totally stole it. That was the buzz coming out of press screenings.
He is great. I still think that Margot Robbie delivers in mm-hmm. a different type of way, which After you watch this movie a couple times, the Ryan Gosling bits are going to kind of fade from memory. I think we'll, you know, just with any sort of comedy, like the more and more you watch it, kind of the less fun you're going to have with it. But like her
emotional
performance
core
and the emotional through line with her, I think is being honestly like a little undervalued because Ryan Gosling is so fun and he delivers so much. And like anytime they need a change of a pace, he's right there. He's like pitch perfect with the comedy. Physically, like, I just think he's awesome in it. And like, he has so many different, like, he can dance his ass off, he can sing, he can, like, you know, Gosling rocks.
Yeah.
And I still think it's Margot. I do want to give a shout out to somebody who I never shout out. I'm actually somewhat of a hater, but I thought that Kate McKinnon worked really well in this movie.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm normally not a Kate McKinnon fan and didn't really, and you know, I've gotten in debates about like her work on SNL and things like that, but
no,
I thought this was perfect for her.
Yeah.
Weird Barbie was, or Crazy Barbie, that was her name.
No,
she
was
awesome.
No, it was Weird Barbie.
Oh, was it Weird Barbie?
Yeah,
but like always in the splits, and just I thought that she was really, really good as kind of this oracle or like prophet.
Oh yeah, oracle's a great word.
Yeah,
the guide on the journey, like the hero's journey. Do you take the high heels or the Birkenstocks?
The Birkens with the flat foot. Yeah,
yeah.
No, like, give me the high heel. All the bits with like her and all the like misfit toys, all the retreads or the people who had been canceled. And I just, every time she came on, I was like, okay, this is exactly her wheelhouse. Like this
perfectly
is where she should be.
Used, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that Barbie. Everyone knows that fucked up Barbie, you know?
And I love that they were playing, Spice Up Your Life while they do the little montage of the kid fucking up the Barbie and cutting its hair and all that. Yeah. Michael Cera as Alan, perfectly used
well
as well.
Done.
Just
yeah.
the right amount of comedic spice there. I love the fact that, plus these are real, like, these are produced dolls.
Yeah, like, they're real, like, shitty
Alan.
Dolls. Like,
it's Ken's buddy. All of Ken's clothes fit Alan. Oh, cool. Great.
Oh, and there's only one of them in the
whole
place.
I gotta get Alan. I gotta get Ken's buddy. I didn't know Will Ferrell was in this movie, and he kind of has a really tricky role because he plays the suit, right? I mean, this is where it's like, all right, Mattel, like, let Greta do her thing. Don't try to push your message. But he was kind of the perfect face of these ridiculous male-run you know, Barbie company.
Yeah. He's Ken, but in the real world. They even kind of look the same. Like when Ken's wearing the black cowboy suit with pink kerchief, Will Ferrell's black with the pink tie, but he's kind of the real world manifestation of Ken's kind of patriarchy ideas.
He's Ken's idol, or he's what Ken is trying to produce back in Barbie land, right? I guess it's
and
like...
both Ken is trying to put Barbie in a lesser place, and Will is trying to put Barbie back in the box, like trying to reset it to the way it used to be, you know? So like, they kind of mirror each other in a different way, but you
that's
know, and
cool.
Then
I didn't think about that. I mean, but he's, you know, he's doing Will Ferrell things, which I think his career is in the decline, right? He doesn't quite have the fastball, you know, he's throwing maybe 86 these days, but
a little,
it worked.
Greg Maddux time.
Greg Maddux.
A little accuracy over power.
Okay. Uh-huh. But it worked really well. It almost, his shtick like this hasn't worked as well for me since Wedding Crashers, where give him like 10, 15 minutes of screen time. Just, he's an amazing supporting actor as just like a guy that can come in and give you, you know, relief for a couple innings, right?
Yeah.
If we want to continue that analogy. But the only part the movie slowed down was kind of the real world stuff. I liked Ken's journey in the real world, and then
the doctor bits were really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm a man. Is there something shiny sharp I can use right now? Yeah, just like that whole exchange was really nice.
Any exchange with real world people was really funny. Margot, you know, interacting with a child and that whole, like, you know, this is a millennial thing. Now Gen Z doesn't give a shit about Barbie. And then we discover, like, it was the mom who was, like, in playing, trying to get her daughter, trying to interact with her daughter and playing with the dolls. It was her, not the little girl that was having these thoughts of death and stuff like that. But the only part it was, like, the chase sequence, like, that Benny Hill, kind of the Will Ferrell, the suits chasing after Barbie, very slapstick. There was, like, a few moments where I was like, all right, let's get back to like Barbie Land already. And
yeah,
if I were to give a knock, I think that maybe some of those sequences, but
I did kind of like the music during the chase sequence. It was kind of like funky, but yeah, I did like that. You, in order to get to from the real world to Barbie Land and back, you basically have to take all of the different modes of transportation that they sold. So it's like you have to use the car, into the snowmobile, into the boat, into the rollerblades. You know, and
well,
then
no, it always starts with the rollerblades.
Yeah, so yeah, Will Ferrell like gets everyone rollerblades, and they start. Like,
it always starts with a rollerblade.
But you know, that's there's a lot to be identifying, and you know, I'm sure you know, women in corporate America could probably relate to like the corporate only elevator and kind of like going into that boardroom, and you know, Greta Gerwig said she wanted it to look a lot like Dr. Strangelove, kind of like war room table, and you know, it's just like, and it's like just all white dude faces, and just kind of
gentlemen,
what that,
you can't fight
what
in here.
That's
this
like.
Is the war room.
Yeah. But the and the only woman that kind of is even around that boardroom is the executive assistant, which is played by the mother. So it's like, you know, that's kind of the, like that's what it looks like. And kind of Barbie's questioning of like, where are all the women? Like, what you know, just her, like her, that's that childhood idealism where she like shows up and she thinks everyone's going to give her a hug because of the huge difference she's made in the world. And it's like actually made no difference at all. It hurt us a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I just it was hilarious. Do you have any best bits that you liked? Because I've got a couple.
It might have to be the Ken serenading on the beach. I just think that was like, that is cutting at the kneecaps a lot of douchey dudes right now, and I love that. A lot of the dance sequences in general I thought were so awesome. Like the Ken battle sequence that turned into like a guys and, well, not guys and dolls, but like a Singing in the Rain, old school, you know, Gene Kelly sort of influenced, it just looked amazing. The cinematography, the sets for that stuff. I was really impressed by that. Yeah, I mean, you go for it.
Yeah, I mean, most of the comedy comes through Ken. But yeah, I loved the just everyone singing the exact same Matchbox 20 song. I wanna take you for granted. I'm Just Ken was a nice bit. Went on a little too long, but I did like that. I just like Ken in despair at the end was nice, but the Casa Dojo house, what was it called? It was the something Casa Dojo house, but just the terminology once they got back to the Kendom, and it was like the brewski beer and stuff that was just that just
here's
was,
your brewski beer.
But yeah, Ken in despair when he finds out that the house is no longer his and he like goes back through his saloon doors. I was definitely, that was like one of my favorite bits.
So. I got a good one. When he shows up to the end with that like tie-dye furry hoodie, I'm Kenuff.
Yeah,
like,
good bit.
What an iconic piece of, and I've already looked on Mattel's website. It is sold out.
Oh, the Halloween costume. This Barbie is going to win Halloween this year. You know, definitely. I always look at what's going to be, you know, the Halloween buzz. And if you thought Tiger King was a movement in Halloween, Barbie is taking 100%. Over your Halloween party.
Absolutely. Pink neon skates, just like all the Ken outfits. Just, you can't go wrong. I mean, all the outfits in this movie, you could pick any one of them. They look incredible.
Yeah.
So. I might go as Alan. Should we transition? Talk a little Oppenheimer?
Let's talk.
Yeah, let's, I mean, catch our breath. A huge recommend on Barbie, obviously. And then, you know, Christopher Nolan's our guy, man. I mean, just banger after banger. Flew to Chicago to see Tenet with the first, you know, movie that tried to reopen theaters. But, I mean, that was a weird experience, right? Almost the complete opposite where no one was there and we're all like, don't want to cough. Still don't know what happened in that movie, but this is a masterpiece, right? It's I mean, you were saving your takes earlier. I was just in awe of the technical filmmaking.
Yeah.
The sound design, the score, editing. I mean, we're talking a lot of nominations here right now, but like, God, the gorgeous look of this, I think considering the material, how like it kept going at a pretty sharp pace, right? And then I think you have to talk about the fact that like the first 2 hours are like this total thrill ride, and then it's like the third hour is this courtroom drama, and I think people are kind of getting lost in that final third. I still found it thrilling, Jason Clarke as the prosecutor, and this whole back and forth between timelines, classic Nolan, right? Robert Downey Jr. just putting in a performance for the, I haven't seen him play an asshole in forever, crushing it and just like being such a great heel. I had a good time the entire time. Obviously, it's a totally different experience. There's no real laugh out loud moments, but I was literally blown away. Pun intended. Especially during the explosion, where you're like, "All right, here it is, big blast. Let's do it, Nolan. I'm in an IMAX. Let's hear it." And then it goes silent. And you're like, and you're just like,
you just hear the sound of his breath. Yeah,
and just hear the breath. I mean, when he cuts out the sound, there's two moments, right? It's where Oppenheimer's kind of delivering to that raucous gymnasium,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a horror film.
Yeah,
because it's like the weight of what he has accomplished is like seeping into him, and man, just incredible, incredible performances, visually, sound, everything.
Yeah, I mean, it really to me was kind of surprising, actually, in that for a movie about the atomic bomb, it's really a lot of intimate moments.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things happening in rooms. There's a ton of intercutting between one courtroom in a small room versus a larger hearing. I think act one, you're kind of trying to catch your breath. And, mm-hmm. It's like him in college, but then meeting this guy, but then blah, blah, blah. And, there was a lot of times where like Brecken was asking me like, who's that guy? And I was like, I don't fucking know who that guy is, but apparently he's watching his kids. And then, there's mm-hmm. just like a lot of that happening. And then kind of like as Damon comes into the movie, it kind of like, you get back on track a little bit. And act two and the whole Manhattan Project and Trinity, like that was gripping. And like everything you just said, just like and that's where Nolan's at his best is, like technical filmmaking. It's very ambitious. It's beautiful filmmaking. I also sometimes found it like kind of cold and clinical. And this has been something I've said about Nolan, and I'm not the only person to say it, but like sometimes I have a hard time connecting emotionally to his mm-hmm. movies.
Yeah.
And I understand the Oppenheimer is this kind of complicated guy. And I think the way that he's able to kind of like tell with the black and white versus the color, kind of the subjective versus objective points of view, he's obviously making a comment, and Nolan said this, where he's like, this guy was a loving husband but also a womanizer. Like he had a duality to him. He was incredibly arrogant, but he also like was incredibly empathetic about the consequences of his decision making. And then he was a visionary scientist that sought to understand the world, but also created something that could destroy the world. So he had this like duality to him. So he wanted the movie to read like that. And so like, that's a really ambitious, and I always love and will take Nolan's ambitious filmmaking and storytelling. But to me, I wish I connected with his characters a little more.
Right.
And
it's
so
a lot of concept and visuals, right? Like Tenet, mm-hmm. Dunkirk. I mean, do we care about any of those characters? That they're kind of stand-ins for the overall
right. concept of the movie, right?
Inception are just kind of like, they're vehicles for exposition, right? And trying to explain the world.
Yeah,
it's like actually kind of connecting.
But it's like this time it's so well done where I can overlook it. Like honestly, it was one of the best movies I've seen in a long time. Brecken was floored. And honestly, we were talking about it, and there was a trailer before the movie with Paul Giamatti in a movie called The Leftovers. I don't know if you saw the trailer for The Leftovers in your screen, but Paul Giamatti's like this like 60s history teacher.
Yeah, it's Alexander Payne reuniting, the
Exactly,
sideways.
Yeah, yeah, a new Alexander Payne movie. But there's a line in it that actually like really made me think about Oppenheimer. So like the whole night to me was kind of an experience, but it was like, and I wrote this down, it was... history doesn't just tell us where we've been, but it informs where we are right now. And, I think like that plays a lot with Oppenheimer in that there's this there's these chain reactions and ripples of decision making that connect over time. And, you know, as you're leaving the theater and he's seeing, you know, he's looking out after he's talked to Einstein, and you finally get the context of that Einstein conversation, and you see his imagination and all the atomic bombs kind of like crossing his face. And it's like, you know, these men, and sometimes my favorite scenes were with him and Truman and with him and Damon, but kind of they make these decisions for whatever reason, and sometimes they're not well thought out, sometimes they're based in hubris and ego, but like, you know, like these small men and small-minded men sometimes have these incredible impacts in their decision making across the course of history. And so like that to me was just incredible. And I do have issues with, I'm bored by the narrative of kind of like McCarthyism and
yeah,
like,
me too. Actually, that's interesting you bring that up, because like there's so, anytime we go back to that era. I'm like, oh, Jesus, like I, like what a fucking ridiculous time this was, but it's always these heavy scenes. It's like. It's
are
hard
you
to
a communist?
Read.
Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
And it's like, and look, so here's a
get
few movies, even
here.
Just recently, that deal with the same themes. Being the Ricardos, Good Night and Good Luck. Good Night and Good Luck is pretty obvious. Trumbo, the Bryan Cranston Trumbo movie, Dalton Trumbo, which I really enjoyed. The Julia Childs movie with Meryl Streep. The Majestic is a Jim Carrey movie, but honestly, it's become a little subgenre now of just like the McCarthy witch hunts, but. With that said, Act Three is all in that space, right? People talking in rooms. But I do like at the end that they tag it that was his personal penance, you know, and there's all these questions. Why are you putting yourself through this? Why do you know you can't win this battle? Like, why even go through? And it's like he's giving himself his lashings for the decision to create the bomb.
He's
and so
totally
I was like, that's
peace.
That's really sound. That's great storytelling.
No, because like, God, how many times do we have to like, man, I really hate the Jason Clark prosecutor character. I really hate all these fucking senators who are just like, you know, you're taking this great man and you're just like bringing down the weight of your bullshit, stupid beliefs just because the wrong party is in power. You know what I mean? Just throughout history, just the politics that we're constantly reminded of, you know, the split that goes back, you know, for 50, 60 years. And just how many times do I have to watch a character deliver the heinous dialogue? It's really hard to kind of sit through a lot of that. But yeah, you're right. It's like, you know, the Strauss guy doesn't get what he wants. Oppenheimer kind of comes away completely at peace. We're like, yeah, you know what? Take my clearance. It's like you can't really get to me. I am safe in my, you know, personal knowledge that like maybe I flirted with socialism or kind of there's communism and then there's Soviet communism, right? That's like harmful and dangerous, and I'm at peace with where I stand and my beliefs. And he basically just wanted to be a part of history, right? Where he talks about, you know, donating to, you know, the Spanish Civil War and just kind of wanting to be on the right side of history. And then these people are just kind of putting their own beliefs and fears and trying to just like root out. It's just,
and you got to tell that story though. Like you can't tell the Oppenheimer story without talking about how he was received after the bombs were dropped. To me, and this is where I guess I'll wrap up my thought around kind of the clinical nature of the way that Nolan tells stories. I would have rather spent more time personally understanding Oppenheimer and how he felt. And they give you some of it, but they spent more time on kind of the impact and how the world received him. And that's
right.
Kind of, and so I'd rather have spent more time with the character than kind of the political history part of it. And that's that, you know, you get away from emotionally connecting with him and you get more into a history lesson.
That's a great call. Yeah, because like the political weight of the repercussions. I mean, it's kind of cool, like where the world is now, there's an atom bomb, and like the fact that we beat Germany to getting one, and that was the main draw. Like,
they took a wrong turn.
Yeah, I know what happens when Germany gets the bomb. That's why we're all here. But in saving the world, did I destroy it? Mm-hmm. I think this is what he says to Einstein, right?
Yeah, the breaker of worlds thing. Yeah.
You're so right. Yeah, I am a destroyer of worlds. I am become death, destroyer of worlds. Mm-hmm. While having sex, reading Sanskrit. Yeah.
But you were saying I was so right, so I want to hear why I was so right.
Yeah, of course. No, the fact that, because like you said, in the first 2 hours, we can't even catch our breath. It's like, it's just the cliff notes of how this student who is, you know, not allowed to go see a Niels Bohr speech all of a sudden became the inventor of this incredible technology and on a level of Einstein and like his contemporary. Yeah. I kind of wanted to sit with that a little bit because you're right. It's like, okay, we're here. We're doing this. Now he's running this. He's in Berkeley. He's this guy. Manhattan Project.
But also cut within like more people in rooms and like, what's this room about? Like, you know, and you're just kind of like, there's a lot to take in.
Yeah, I think had we spent more time there, like you were saying, I think that would have been really enjoyable or cool. And that's also why I've the book American Prometheus I just bought, because I want to know more about the history of this guy and how he got into the position of being the creator of the atom bomb and running this project.
Yeah,
as
I'll probably
opposed
want
to
read that too. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can do like a little
book club.
Analysis,
but anyway.
Book club. Mm-hmm. But as opposed to the weight of the machine coming down politically, and everyone's got to get their piece of this. You know, it's like Truman is almost jealous of this guy's fame, right? And then everyone starts nibbling at, you know,
the Truman scene. And there's so many, like, you have Casey Affleck that comes in, delivers just a little bit of a banger. You've got, like,
Josh
Gary
Hartnett
Oldman.
As well, man.
Josh Hartnett. That you got just, like, the amount of people that fucking Rami Malek showed up to be weird for 20 minutes. I'm like, get him out of here. I'm so, like, any sort of real movie where it doesn't need a weirdo, like a Bond movie, I'm all set with Rami Malek. I just wanted to say that real quick. But,
yeah, I knew
but
you
the
would
Truman
have
scene,
that reaction.
I've got blood on my hands, and then he pulls out the kerchief, and it's just like, no one gives a shit about who built the bomb or who's the father of the bomb. They care about who made the decision to drop it. And he's totally right.
Right.
He's like, this is how I wipe the blood off my hands and live with a guilt-free conscience. But like also his like arrogance and that hubris of like, the Russians won't get a bomb. And it's just like, I think it goes back to, you can be a genius, and this is the first time in kind of at least American history where scientists became kind of like godly or rock stars was this. And it's obviously like played out in subsequent decades. But at the end of the day, like, genius can also get you in trouble. And, you know, you can't be an asshole. You can't undermine people. You can't fuck people's wives. Like, it's going to come back to haunt you no matter how genius you are. And so I think playing out during some of, you know, Act 3 as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like this funny, like, super team of nerds that they assembled, right? It's almost like LeBron joining up with Bosh and Wade. Just like this super team of, or, you know, or like the Gorillas, right? It's like a super band. Just, you got all these brilliant minds coming together and just like rocking out, producing a greatest hits album. Yeah, no, it was cool. Like the Truman scene, like you said, it's cool how in absolving his sins, he was kind of being a dick about, like, you know, no one gives a shit about you, man. Like, why are you so worried about this?
Never bring that crybaby back into my room. I was like, God, Oldman just steps up to deliver. He's played Churchill and Truman.
Yeah, amazing. What a G. What I found kind of funny, this was like an interesting kind of fan theory that I wrote down, where it's like, you know, because Nolan, he likes to put himself into a lot of these movies about kind of great men being great, and now it's hard to be a great man, and people don't understand genius, and it's always underappreciated. And
but is he saying I'm underappreciated and I'm a great man?
I'm a great man.
Hey, well, I'm a great man. Okay.
There's a fan theory going around where this movie is Nolan kind of questioning. Or maybe feeling guilty about creating the atom bomb that is comic book movies by doing The Dark Knight.
Oh, my God. That's real. That's a thing.
So it's like, Dark Knight as the inventor of the comic book juggernaut, and in saving the world with this great movie, he also destroyed the world, because now we're left to live with nothing but Marvel and DC Comics. And that's kind of why we got Robert Downey Jr. in there playing a stooge, like, asshole, because he's Iron Man and he started this whole thing.
I don't care if that was... I would love the fact that that was Nolan's intention. Either way, it's absolutely correct, and I that's my truth now.
Right?
Thank you. Well, I that is so good.
Is that fun? You know, like, Batman Begins, Prestige, Dark Knight, this thing totally takes off. And then ever since, you know, he's trying to do these really important...
And no one gives a shit because they're going out to see someone in boots with
right?
laser eyes.
Yeah. People in capes punching and kicking each other. And he was the guy that created the craze. I mean... What, Batman Begins predates Iron Man, right? So you can make the case that the Marvel blockbuster was his atom bomb.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting.
Speaking of that, I saw a meme that I snipped here, but it was a Barbie Oppenheimer meme, and it's a Venn diagram. On one side is Oppenheimer, and it says, about a nerd. On the other side, it's Barbie, and it says, about a doll. And then in the middle, it says... in the middle of the Venn diagram, it says, starring a gifted actor who once played the role of a psychotic professional in Gotham City, whose therapeutic misconduct with patients at Arkham Asylum ironically led to their own insanity, bringing them in conflict with Batman. Because the Scarecrow and Harley Quinn,
right.
Both fuck around with Batman.
Hilarious. Yeah,
it's all coming full circle.
Everything comes back to Batman.
Yeah.
I am. Inevitable. It's actually kind of funny that these two movies, although diametrically opposed, and certainly in color palettes at least, but are kind of about like the morality of death and
mm-hmm.
and kind of having a conflict of you know, feeling insecure or questioning your worth and stuff like that.
I'll do you one more. Honestly, and you see this with the Ken fight, but the Barbies inevitably rely on the male nature towards violence and self-destruction. And that's part of their strategy to regain, you know, their presidency and their Senate and so and their Supreme Court. But I think, you know, there's this innate ability for men to want to be violent and be in conflict, and you know, there's also ego and hubris and kind of like small-minded points of view to try to feel and gain power. And so, yeah, I think the movies do complement each other in a few different ways, but just kind of like the way and kind of destructive nature of man is something that is definitely present in both movies metaphorically, but told in very different ways.
100%. It's hard for me to not. And it's here. The thing about Christopher Nolan is like it's gotten to the point where it's inexcusable that we can't hear the dialogue.
Come on, man.
There's a for fuck's and then this guy goes those aren't ideas, those are effects. No, but like there's a lot of heavy stuff going on here. I was like, wait, who's Niels Bohr again? What did he do? Heisenberg. What were you talking about? Is this Breaking Bad? Like, wait, what did Heisenberg do? And we're like, yeah. But there's a lot of like. You know, the Senate hearing stuff, there's a lot of like intricate details. And I'm like, I can't understand what they're saying. It's like,
where's the Senate saying that? The Manhattan Senate.
Yeah, it sounds like when you're on a roller coaster at Cedar Point.
Enjoy the ride, bro. America's Rock and Roller Coaster.
Brought to you by Chris Nolan. But yeah, I don't want to leave our podcast without talking about how big of a pimp Oppenheimer was. Dude was not just slaying butts, but like his best friend's wife's butts. Like, guy was just all over the place.
Florence Pugh, we
basically signs up to be naked
Emily
for a bunch
Blunt.
Of time.
Emily Blunt, yeah, right. Yeah, I'll be in a Nolan film just to get topless and Can you imagine shooting the scene where they're in this little room?
Yeah, I was
the kangaroo court, and she's just like riding him as like a flashback.
That was a very uncomfortable moment, I think, for everyone.
Well, again, it's, you know, he's got to answer the fact that he underwrites female characters yet again. But
I thought Emily Blunt was a little underused.
Apparently that character Kitty is like a brilliant scientist or therapist in her own right or something. Mm. But you know, we don't really get that at all. It's like totally brushed over.
Yeah, you don't really get a lot of them together in general.
How do you think our boy Damon does? I mean, because he's kind of like in a different movie, right?
No, he's kind of the like burly military guy. He kind of represents, you know, Cillian Murphy, we haven't talked about nearly enough on this podcast, yeah. But with all that IMAX, how intimate it gets, back to what I was saying, so much on his face when it comes to like deceiving, mm-hmm. but also like pain, agony, stress. Like he just, he wears so much. He's like, honestly, I should lock in Cillian Murphy for best actor because I think he's going to walk with it. The movie absolutely needs him because of how intimate it is. And he's just incredible. But, you know, the kind of like the science and what the scientific community and like what they're after versus the military and kind of those two things, like both like pushing and pulling and kind of cross deceiving each other in different ways. Like I thought Damon really delivered in terms of kind of that military brute space. And then they also want the same things. Too. They also had the same, some of the same needs, right?
Yeah, he's not just like that scrappy upstart in Ocean's 11, right? He's coming in and playing a role and kind of giving the movie a little bit of like a levity, right? He's kind of this snarky general who, you know, he's kind of like the Aaron Sorkin dialogue guy, right? Mm-hmm. He's kind of the quick talking, no nonsense kind of guy. I think he jolted the movie a little bit and kind of brought it back from like so serious pain, anguish. He's just like, I need this done. I need this done now. Why is it not getting done? Like,
the collaborative between them. There's that scene when they all are figuring out, you know, who's likely, what's the most likely spot to drop the bomb in Japan. And there's the one fucking attorney general or somebody, some asshole that's like, well, and also my wife and I have a vacation there for our honeymoon.
We vacation there. Drop it somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. Yeah. Like, this is South Park.
No, definitely. Beautiful place. Yeah, go drop it over there. 80,000 people. Well, speaking of South Park, Randy Marsh, you know, teaching us how to do the Nagasaki fart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to teach you a fart called the Nagasaki. It's called the Nagasaki because if you do it right, it makes people go, ooh.
But, yeah, so, I mean, Damon was great. Casey Affleck coming in as the creepy general, the murderous general. I think I loved Gary Oldman. I mean, just anybody who's anybody wants to come in and do a Nolan movie, which shows you just what his place is in Hollywood in general. But
and I love that Cillian Murphy's been a Nolan guy for a while. He's in a lot of these movies, collaborated for 20 years. Peaky Blinders, I'm a huge fan. It was cool to see him get a starring role in a Nolan vehicle. Who knows? Maybe he could have been in Interstellar and kind of could have elevated that. I thought he was great.
He was awesome.
Fantastic. I think you're right to flirt with a lock in here. I mean, definitely a nomination coming for him. I think this movie is going to rake at the awards, especially with like a lot of stuff because of the strikes getting pushed. So who knows what other movies are going to come out that'll be any good. I still think Past Lives is really awesome. But then, you know, Margot and Barbie, nom there. I think they've served themselves well to
two great movies with great performances. You know, get some people back on your side. How about this? A little negotiation. Instead of 3 points of a lock-in, if I went for it right now, would you give me 4?
Locked in to win right now, Cillian?
Mm-hmm. In July.
All right, yeah.
Let's lock it in!
Lock it in, Cillian, winning
it's
Best
locked.
Actor.
Bring it on, baby. Let's go, Cillian. Ride or die.
You have still not seen Across the Spider-Verse. I'm going to lock that in right now.
It's locked.
Winning, animated film.
Okay. So we got two lock-ins early, baby. We're doing. We're on this year. Okay. Cool.
I'll just take the 3 on that one, though. But 4 right now, Cillian winning. I mean, that's a good call. I mean, nomination. Who's I can't think of anyone that's going up against him right now.
I just can't. I can't think of a better performance in a more important and kind of like culturally impactful movie. I just feel it. I feel it coming. Yeah. So.
Cool. Yeah. What a concept. Produce two exciting movies that people want to see, and they'll come see it. You know, build it, and they will come. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly.
Fucking A. Been so long. So exciting to get people back to the movies. People that haven't been to the theater in years it's awesome. So exciting.
Exactly.
Well, cool. Great chat, man.
I hope we did it service, man. It was one of the bigger movie events since we've been doing this podcast. So
absolutely.
I think we're on our game today. I hope we were able to summon some of that energy and bring it to the podcast.
Get back to the theaters, guys. Come on.
Go to the nearest Regal by you. It's on the side.
You can't wait for these to come out on streaming. One thing I'll say is that, like, Barbie, you know, initially you'd be like, oh, I can wait to see that. It's not something that necessarily requires an IMAX screen. Wrong. That is, like, what's great about these two movies is that you want to see Oppenheimer in the biggest screen possible. You want to see Barbie with your fellow man. Your fellow moviegoers, you know, it's like there's two different experiences happening there, and they're both only achievable in a big movie theater. So I love that, like, because you get like the camaraderie and like you're laughing, empathetic crying. It's like the excitement of the theater buzz, and then same, but because you're all having this shared experience of like jaw dropping, awe inspiring images. So. Very cool. I love both experiences. I'm so glad I got to take part.
Absolutely, man. Well, audience, we thank you guys for taking part in our conversation today. And, you know, if you guys want some additional footage, our deposition and McCarthyism hearings, we're going to be following this shortly. So appreciate you guys hanging with us. I hope you guys enjoyed the movies as much as we did. And don't forget to treat each other with respect. Smash the subscribe button. See you down the road.
See you at the movies.
Yeah, we just might feel good. I wanna push you around. And I don't know why you couldn't just